fast growth isn't necessarily the best growth. Hello, this is Jonathan Mays, Editor-in-Chief of Restaurant Business, and on this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, I speak with Pete Pescuzzi, CEO of Mexican Restaurants, Inc., to talk about the company's growth strategy. MRI is a Texas company that operates several chains, including Uberito, Casa Ole, Monterey's Little Mexico, Tortuga, and Crazy Joe's. Pete talks about why the company is more deliberative with its franchisee and site selection, and why that works for his company. A lot of mistakes get made when chains quickly get franchisees into the system and then push them into bad sites. Pete talks generally about site availability right now and notes that his company has had success looking outside of traditional markets for its growth. Please have a listen.
Okay, I am here with Pete Pescuzzi. Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about MRI and the company and its history, if you could.
Sure. We've been in the restaurant business since back in the 50s when Monterey, Little Mexico opened up. Offspring from that was Casa Ole. Those were two competitors, and then eventually Casa bought Monterey's. We bought them back about 12, 13 years ago. We've got five brands. We've got Monterey's Little Mexico, which is a full service, authentic Mexican food. We lean towards more of the street tacos, the white queso. It's all scratch cooking every day, but very flavorful, but a little bit more seasoning. Casa Ole is the traditional Tex-Mex restaurant. Again, both concepts are full service. We've got a bar in probably two-thirds of the restaurants. They seat anywhere from the small size of 100 people to upwards of 280 people. We've got a really cool concept down in Galveston right on the beach called Tortuga. It's a Tex-Mex concept, meet Caribbean flares. The tiki huts, the bars, the outside patio, a lot of seafood flavor profiles through the menu. Out in East Texas, we've got a little concept called Crazy Jose's. It's Americana meets Tex-Mex. So you kind of walk in the restaurant and get a feel that you're at an old Route 66 diner. So we've got a lot of the Americana favorites, but we also have mixed in the Tex-Mex. And of course, we've got Uberito that we've owned for since 2006. Mm-hmm. And it's what we feel is probably one of the premier build your own burrito concepts right now available.
Mm-hmm. And now you came to the company last year, yeah?
Right. I came right at the beginning of COVID. I took over the brand in April of 2020. So got kind of thrown in the fire right away, but I've been in this business quite a while, and I knew the restaurants because I've been in Texas for 30 years, excited about the opportunity. We've got, look, in a lot of opportunities, you've got to fix the food and fix the people. We have amazing food in all our concepts, and I was blessed with a tremendous team here.
Mm-hmm. Why Mexican?
You know, why not? It's, you know, it's one of the top of the list flavor profiles, mm-hmm. whether it's authentic food that's very street-wise, street tacos with a lot of flavors, spicy, or whether it's Tex-Mex, which kind of appeals to across the communities to a lot of different flavor profiles. And of course, you know, build your own burritos and tacos and bowls and fajitas. It seems that everybody out there is enjoying Tex-Mex food. Mm-hmm. And hey, we're based in Texas.
Right.
What else would we want to focus on?
Right. So now how many locations do your concepts have?
We're totally a group of 40 right now.
Mm-hmm. And is Uberito is probably the largest of those, isn't it?
Actually, Uberito is next to our smallest unit. Mm-hmm. We've been building a few company locations. We're just now gearing up for our franchise push. Mm-hmm. We've been taking our time. you know, my philosophy is selection over speed. Mm-hmm. So we've gone in and built a better infrastructure, brought in some really talented people. We've created a new footprint that allows for both a pickup window and a drive-through lane. And we're out right now building a custom food truck that's going to be almost a mimic of our cafeteria line that we're producing. I'll have ready for the franchisees to start using by early fall. So our biggest brand is Casa, followed by Monterey's. But we're looking at some really steady growth for Uberito.
Mm-hmm. You guys have a pretty good selection there of sort of fast casual and casual dining Mexican restaurants, yeah?
Absolutely. Plus, we've got a ghost kitchen that we've developed. It will be brought out in about two more weeks. We'll start that in one of our Uberitos. In fact, it's the second oldest unit over in Durham. And we feel like it's going to offer another revenue source for our franchisees on the Uberito side.
Really? So the franchisees would operate the ghost kitchens? Is that how that works?
We're going to make it available to them. Mm-hmm. There's only one piece of equipment they need to bring in. There's only one new proprietary product, but the menu will be traditional quality, high quality, made from scratch, Tex-Mex food. Plus, we do have spicy wings, barbecue wings. So we've got a little bit of everything. It'll start out with 12 menu items, and then we'll see from there where it grows.
So is this, are you talking, is this a sort of, how much, well, let me ask you this, how much interest from franchisees are you getting on an idea like that?
You know, so far, they've been very interested. You know, franchisees, and I've been a franchisee, so I can relate to their side. They're going to wait and see what happens, but what we've got an opportunity to offer a little different menu without it happened to be on the Uberito menu at the brick and mortar stores. It also enables us to offer this to our other full service restaurants as an off meal period supplement. But you know, we've added wings, which seems to be one of the number one items out there in ghost kitchens. And we've added a Texas flair, Tex-Mex flair to the wings. So we're pretty excited about what it's gonna do.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking basically about what amounts to be a virtual brand that could go into any one of your concepts?
Absolutely. It'll be delivered by third-party vendors. It'll be supported with website and social media and geo-targeting. But it will have the availability that it doesn't require any additional labor. So you can add that. Look, if you're really busy at lunch, you just turn off the third-party deliveries. Slow part of the afternoon, evening, or if you need to do a promotion during 2 to 5, and we geo-target the location, and we drive in a whole nother source of third-party deliveries.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to one of the comments you said. You said that you focus on site selection over speed. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, a lot of times when you're out franchising, Jonathan, the goal is to grow and grow quickly. Unfortunately, I've seen that sometimes that brings with it the possibility that you've sold franchises instead of awarded them. So what we're looking at, besides better site selection tools to offer the franchisees, we're looking for people that fit our culture, that fit into what we feel like is the ideal operator, you know, somebody with a background in either retail or hospitality, already is an entrepreneur, possibly multi-branded with other concepts. And so we're taking our time with our vetting process. We, you know, we've gone out and selected 3 new real estate brokers to handle site selections for franchisees who don't have their own network of brokers. These 3 groups are collectively probably got 75 years of whether retail or restaurant site selection, and they bring with them all the tools to really help that franchisee find the perfect location. Mm-hmm. But we're going to build strategically and at a pace that we feel like supports our values, that we've got the right relationship-driven partnership. So, you know, it's not about just throwing a bunch of sites out there and seeing what sticks. So we want every one of our franchisees to be successful and successful from the start.
Yeah, it's a lot of mistakes, I think, in this industry have been made by companies that are investor backed, that push hard to grow. And the result is that companies end up making really bad decisions, get expensive real estate, get sites that don't quite work for the concept, or some sort of combination of the two. And it can be a real, you know, like growing for growth's sake is a terrible idea to me.
Totally agree. Look, we've reduced our footprint to make our restaurants more efficient. So that's going to open up more availability to some of the smaller markets. There's a really good inventory of secondary locations that reduces the cost of entry by half. And, you know, I'm not looking at driving our franchise sales. I'm looking at driving our long-term stability with franchisees. Luckily, we're privately held. Our board of directors are on board with strategic growth and getting the right people in with our Uberito brand. And so our pace will be probably 5 to 8 units this year, and probably somewhere around 25 or 30 next year. If it's more through area developers and area agent deals, that's great. If it's less, as long as we sign the right franchisee, the board's happy and I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. Since you operate both fast casual and casual dining, is it easier to find certain types of sites than at others? I mean, are you having an easier time with casual dining than fast casual, for instance?
You know, Houston's a big market, third largest city, I think, in the country, and a lot of competition here. So, you know, we're all looking for the same spaces. With Uberito, you know, we can convert a 1,400 end cap to a Uberito. And right now we're looking at some QSR restaurants that are 2,600 and already have a drive through, but they've got great locations that we can convert. All for full service restaurants, you know, there's 6,500 to 7,000 square feet. And there's not a lot of secondary market. So there you're looking at new construction.
Really?
So the availability of what we want is not as abundant as we are in the smaller footprint. There's just seems to be quite a bit of that 1,800 to 2,800 square feet, whether it's brand new construction or secondary, out there in the market right now.
Really? That's kind of the opposite of what I would think, given the level of demand that you see from limited service concepts to expand right now. But you're telling me that you're having an easier time finding sites for the smaller concept.
Well, you know, we find them. The finding is not the problem, Jonathan, is being competitive with the pricing. You know, landlords obviously are looking for a premium price, but because of our footprint and because of our economics, the scale, a lot of our Uberitos are looking, we're placing them outside the city, you know, in smaller towns. And a lot of brands want to stay and have penetration within Houston, or say within a Dallas or an Austin. And, you know, there is, as you grow, you've got areas 40 and 50 miles further away. You know, like in Dallas, Frisco and Wiley are not considered outlying suburbs like they were 10 years ago. So, yeah, we're looking at some great sites in market, but we've got the flexibility to keep moving out, whether it's north or south, as the developers build. And our three brokerage groups have got great associations with developers. So, you know, we're getting some first looks before a lot of other people are at these sites.
Mm-hmm. What kind of reception do you get in some of these small towns? I've heard before that when a concept, especially, you know, the cooler the concept, the better the reaction they get when they open some of these smaller towns, because they just don't really have as much I mean, I've also been corrected before on commenting that smaller towns aren't competitive, but it seems like that there is a potential source of development in some of these smaller and more outlying areas than I think a lot of operators realize.
Jonathan, you know, you're correct. There can be some of that resistance in these small towns because they don't like change. Mm-hmm. We make a very concentrated effort to get involved in the community from day one. Mm-hmm. We find whether it's a local charity or the Red Cross or Habitat for Humanity, one of the things we'll do with our new food truck is that as we start the construction process in, say, a small town, we'll find a charity and we'll bring the food truck out to the site and we'll give away food or sell food and donate the entire collection that day to the charity. And we try to build a partnership with the charity to where throughout the year we can help with fundraisers. And then with the food truck and with our restaurants, whenever there's a crisis and there's a need to feed the volunteers or the EMS techs or, the emergency support system, we'll be out there feeding them for free and supporting the community. So they see us not as a foe, but a friend. Mm-hmm. Because we're there to support them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're bringing new jobs to the market,
right?
Which is, which helps the economy, the taxes we pay. A lot of times the property we're looking at has been vacant for a while, and we come in, spend quite a bit of money and get it to be one of the nicest restaurants in the community.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that it's actually that you have to put a little bit of effort to get a good reception in some of these places.
You have to put a lot of effort because you want to see them. You want them to see you as someone there to benefit the community. We're not there just to, build sales and take the bottom line. We constantly try to give something back to the community, whether it's supporting the high schools, whether it's supporting the hospitals, and being available for them whenever they call and have a need. And I think because of that, this ongoing relationship is that we have a great partnership with the community.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you able to staff these new locations? That seems to be the biggest challenge that restaurants face right now is labor. How are you doing on that front?
Labor obviously is us. Always a big issue. The advantage is that at Uberito, we've always paid quite a bit more for the minimum wage. Our kitchen staff was already at that $13 to $16 hours, and our frontline people are averaging between $12 and $15. So, we're paying way above market, and we'll continue to pay whatever hourly rate we need to pay to get in the premier people. Plus we do everything, we do retention bonuses, free meals, meal discounts when they're off duty. We do family nights where they can bring their family in and eat free. And we're very flexible with our scheduling. It's important to have enough, employees on the payroll so that if they need a particular night off, it's easy to get. We only need 5 people, maybe 6 at the peak of our hours. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the staffing need that my full service restaurants do.
Mm-hmm. Why did you guys have that strategy of paying employees more early on? What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, first of all, you get the best talent. Mm-hmm. And talented employees take pride in their work. Everything we do is a scratch menu every day. Throughout the day, we're cooking fresh food. The people on the front line, that's our hospitality ambassadors. And so we want them to be happy in the job and take pride. That's why we get them involved, whether it's in their sorority or fraternity or their high school team needs support. But we know that happy employees will help you keep happy guests, and it cuts down on turnover, and you're going to pay that in rehiring and training costs. So why not just pay it up front and get the best employees and keep them?
Right. So you say that's helped you guys get through this, get through the labor shortage a little bit easier. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my full service restaurants have a staff of 40 or 50, you know. Uberito, you know, we're probably talking about a staff of 15. And at the peak, you know, we have five or six. In the slow part of the afternoon, we can run it with two. Plus the fact that through COVID, even though there was the occupancy limits, 70% of our business was takeout or third party. So we were able to keep a lot of our employees on payroll, whereas the full service restaurants, if they got cut down in occupancy, they had to cut down on staff. So, you know, that meant a lot to our employees.
So, how are your full service restaurants doing from a labor standpoint right now?
You know, we've got a majority of them fully staffed. We've got a small handful in a few markets that we're being a little bit more aggressive. We're doing sign-on bonuses. We're doing referral bonuses because we want the good employees to bring in their friends. But now that, you know, we've seen the state cut off that extra unemployment, the amount of quality applicants coming in with looking for a serious interview is doing much better for us, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm. Did you see, saw an influx of applicants after June?
Yeah, well, we cut off the state of Texas cut off that extra federal funding on July 25th. So probably the week after that, we started getting quite a bit more. It's been great for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So have you been able to fully staff then since then because of that?
Majority of our restaurants are fully staffed. Again, we've got a few in each of the other four brands. They've got a little bit of hiring needs. You know, Tortuga is located on the beach, and you've got the situation there that your staff has to double during season. And then when season is over, which is just now starting to end, you know, you drop back down to like a normal staffing. So that's always been one of our hardest restaurants to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. You get any concerns at all about the Delta variant down there in Texas? Has that had any sort of influence on customer count or staffing at all?
You know, unfortunately, Texas is a hotspot for Delta. I think everybody has seen the news and know that between Texas and Florida, we've had an influx in it. So we have gone back, and for the safety of our employees and the safety for our guests, we've got all our employees back in masks, both back of the house, front of the house. We're doing our health questionnaires before they come to work. At the beginning of the shift, there's five questions we ask them, and we take their temperature to make sure they're able to work that day. We've got strict protocols for COVID that we follow, and we stepped up a really significant sanitation program to try to keep any outbreaks to a minimum. We don't see a lot of guests wearing masks when they come in. As you can imagine, it's down here in Texas and in our Oklahoma markets, a lot of people have been anti-mask, but we've our sign said it's, you know, we prefer them to enter with the mask, but it's not mandated right now.
Mm-hmm. Why not require them to be masked out of curiosity? A lot of restaurants are doing the same thing, but why not require customers to wear masks?
We're waiting to get and see what the environment is in the market right now. You know, based on the Texas Restaurant Association, they haven't recommended that we require it. As you know, it's a big discussion here whether school children are going to wear a mask or not. And it seems like 50% of the population want to wear a mask and 50% doesn't want to wear a mask. So knowing that it's almost evenly split, we've left it up to the guests to decide if they want to wear a mask. Now, we still have followed, you know, the 6-foot safety protocols in our dining rooms. We've got all the booths separated with plexiglass. You know, we keep the dining room the lobby is still separated by 6 feet. So we're trying to make it as CDC compliant as we can to keep the guests comfortable. But at this point, I can't think of a major restaurant in Houston or Dallas that's mandating guests to wear a mask.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about supply chain issues. We've heard a lot of, there's been a lot of concern about supply chain issues. Most of it appears to be related to the driver shortage. It's very difficult for a lot of operators to get supplies in, and we've started to hear some anecdotal evidence that even some distributors are cutting some restaurants off. Any situation, any issues there for you guys?
You know, from we've been struggling for the last several months to get a lot of our to-go supplies in. Some of that is because manufacturing is not able to keep up with demand. Then they have the distribution problem to get the product that's finished to the distribution center. And then obviously our distributors have the same problems about getting truck drivers in to drive the routes. So we've had to, in a lot of cases, just try to locally buy paper goods, to-go goods, cleaning supplies. Luckily, our protein supplier, who handles our beef and proprietary chicken, they've done an amazing job. We have not had any issues. We've obviously seen some price hikes, but that was expected. But it's definitely affecting us with the to-go products, with whether it's plastic or paper, getting them in enough volume to handle what we need.
Oh, you're not the only one on that. Like McDonald's ran out of paper bags.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and with the increase of third-party delivery and takeout as it is, you know, whether it's paper bags or plastic bags or cup holders or even lids. But we've been, you know, we've been fairly lucky with the bigger items, but it's plasticware, lids to the cups, our to-go containers for Uberitos, a unique container that you can that is domed, and it's, we've had some difficulty. So we switched, around. One of the benefits of Uberito is we don't serve our dining guests in paper bowls or plasticware. We serve in stainless steel bowls with real silverware. So that's taken some of the pressure off our distribution system for Uberito.
But you end up going to Costco sometimes or something like that to get containers.
Absolutely. We've gone to Costco and bought them out on things. And then believe it or not, Costco has limits of how many flats you can pick up and take. And so you have to make multiple trips with multiple employees, but yeah, Costco, the restaurant centers, the restaurant supply companies, we're probably out there 3 times a week, in each of our brands, with our supervisors picking up supplies.
Super. Pete, this was fantastic. I really appreciate you joining us this week on the podcast. Love the conversation.
Jonathan, I appreciate you taking the time. I hope you have a great week.
And that should do it for this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, which was edited, as always, by Kimmy Kazmarek. Artwork by Nico Hines. You may find this and other episodes of the podcast on our website at www.restaurantbusinessonline.com/article/deeper-dive. And you may also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your listening things. I'm Jonathan Mays, your host, podcast producer, and the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business. Thank you for listening.